You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on all the news that made headlines this last week. So today, our panel includes Kevin Richard, reporter and blogger with the Idaho Education News, Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello.
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 So, believe it or not, we are about 5 weeks away from school resuming for many Idaho students. Not that I'm counting it down or anything at my house. But I really do want to start with what this means in regards to COVID. Because, Kevin, you recently talked with some school leaders about the Delta variant because we're finding out that, A, it's more contagious. Kids are getting it. And yet we have a big group of kids not vaccinated.
Yeah, and what I basically found as I did research in this is that there's a whole lot of wait and see going on. And, you know, this is the summer slowdown in schools. A lot of administrators take some time off. So it's kind of downtime. But as we've seen nationally, the numbers on the Delta variant are increasing rapidly. And we're seeing some pretty extensive outbreaks in states like Arkansas and Missouri, and you're seeing pretty big outbreaks in summer camps, like in Texas and Illinois. So those are some warning signs that, as I looked at the story and talked to folks like Dr. David Pate, a friend of Idaho Matters, he has some real concerns about how this might play out in the schools come fall.
Right. And we have talked, you know, with Dr. Pate about that as well. And so then, Kevin, just this morning, the CDC came out with new federal recommendations for students who are vaccinated. Now, these are mandates. They're not requirements. And basically it is that if you are fully vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask in school unless your school has different guidelines, or if you're riding the school bus. So, Kevin, I know you blogged about this morning, so I'm curious about what you wrote, but how do you think this will impact school districts around our state? I mean, because we had such a mishmash as it was, you know, with masks and schools, you know, throughout the whole state.
And I wonder, too, how this set of guidelines is going to play out with parents as they decide whether to vaccinate their kids who are eligible. I mean, right now, children over the age of 12 and older can get the vaccine. But Idaho's vaccination numbers for teenagers are pretty much abysmal. I mean, we're at 13% of 12 to 15-year-olds are fully vaccinated. It gets a little bit better for high school age kids. I think it's like 24% for 16 and 17-year-olds, but not near where you want to be in terms of any kind of herd immunity in the classrooms. And yeah, if you read the CDC guidelines where they're saying vaccinated teachers and vaccinated students do not have to wear masks. It's not recommended that they need to wear masks. And the CDC guidelines also coming out very strongly in support of vaccinations as the best way to ensure normal school operations. I mean, CDC's messaging today was very clear as far as the importance of vaccinations vis-a-vis normal school operations. And right now, I think that's one of the big question marks when you think about Idaho and you think about how the Delta variant may play its way through schools. Those are some very low vaccination numbers. And we also know that we're seeing wide gaps in the vaccination rates in the overall population in different parts of Idaho. I mean, it's almost like we got two Idahos. You've got places like Blaine County where the vaccination numbers are very high, higher, but not as high as the state averages in places like Ada County and Valley County, but a lot of rural Idaho where the vaccination rates are down around 30 to 35%, not even near that 70% threshold that health experts have been talking about for months.
And then what I find interesting about this as well, Kevin, is that, you know, right now, 12 and older, right? And this coming out and saying you don't have to wear masks, which I can appreciate. Yet at the same time, there are schools where you have from, you know, kindergarten through sixth grade, sometimes kindergarten through seven, sometimes K through eight. And that means the majority of your student body isn't vaccinated yet. So
and won't be.
There's just because, so many, right.
Right. I mean, we're probably, you know, maybe months away from approval of the vaccine for children under age 12. I think I'm hearing September is a possibility mm-hmm. where there may be some go ahead for 5 to 12 year olds to get vaccinated. But well, that's September. The school year starts before that.
Right. Right. I tell you, it's going to be interesting to see all of this and how it plays out. And then, Audrey, some health systems here in Idaho made some fairly significant announcements this week. They're going to be requiring all employees to be vaccinated. I'm curious, first off, talk to us about this and this announcement. But then have you heard anything on how employees are reacting to this?
Yeah, I've heard from sources within, you know, the various healthcare employers, what they're hearing from their coworkers and things like that. Basically, what happened is yesterday morning, the two largest health systems in Idaho, St. Luke's and St. Alphonsus, as well as Primary Health Medical Group, which is one of the largest providers of outpatient care. They run clinics. They told their workforces, you need to be vaccinated. You have until basically September to do that. We will honor very limited exemptions for strongly held religious beliefs and if you have a, you know, documented medical reason, but other than that, you need to get vaccinated. And it was interesting that they all kind of came out with it at once, because, you know, you would expect that if one did it, then folks who didn't want to get vaccinated might go to the other hospital. Mm-hmm. So in this situation, the vast majority of people who are employed in healthcare work for those three organizations. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Most of them, all three of them, most of their employees are already vaccinated. It's between 72 and 78%, I think, are already vaccinated. But what that means based on their workforces is that literally thousands of healthcare employees aren't yet vaccinated. And so that's where that gap is with those large health systems, especially. What I'm hearing from folks is that, you know, some people are relieved and happy about this. They have been, I mean, a lot of the folks that I've talked with over the past year and a half have been working at bedside with COVID patients, and they've seen what's happened to these people and their families and their loved ones and the effect that it has on everyone. Some of them have contracted the virus as well. So they are pretty happy about this. There are, however, some folks who are not, who mm-hmm. I heard from a few sources this morning that they were hearing a lot of grumblings from some of their coworkers. And there is some concern that healthcare workers who don't want to get the vaccine will peace out. You know, I don't want mm-hmm. this. You can't force me. I'm not going to do it. The question is, where will they go? Because hospitals all over the country are announcing these requirements for their staff. And it is worth noting that virtually, I mean, I don't know of a hospital that doesn't have a flu vaccination requirement, with the exception locally, I mean, in our region of Oregon, where they can't require it. Mm-hmm. They can't require any vaccines for healthcare employees there. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out over the next month, 2 months.
So Audrey, I have a question.
Go ahead, Don.
So St. Alphonse or St. Luke's health system has about 14,000 employees. 20% of that is 3,000 people. I would imagine right. a lot of their employees are not clinical, right? So like back office and IT.
Right.
And I mean, what would happen if the employees said, well, pound sand, I'm not going to do it. And they had to mass fire 3,000 people. I mean, it's all theoretical, but like it does seem like right. there's sort of a back and forth here to like, yeah, St. Luke's could maybe fire some or St. Al's or Primary Health, but they probably we'd have a tough time getting rid of all of them. Like, it would hobble them. I mean, how does that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know. We're
going to
see.
Because it's rhetorical, but yeah.
Right. And, but I do think it's fair to note that the state of Maryland just announced yesterday that all of the COVID deaths in Maryland in the month of June were from unvaccinated individuals. So you can also understand, I think, whether you agree or not, as to why these healthcare systems are putting this requirement in place.
Yeah, I'm not making it a judgment. I'm just like, I'm looking at the math.
Right, right, right.
It's going to be fascinating to see how it goes, right?
Yeah.
Well, and then, yeah, Dawn, if you really say 3,000, but then you say 3,000 people, Dawn, I mean, even if they do say, okay, I'm out, where, as you mentioned, Audrey, yeah, where do they go for other work then?
Right. And obviously, right, in healthcare jobs, there aren't a lot of places. But right now, as we all know, the labor market's really tight. So if you're an IT specialist, or you work in communication, or, you know, in administrative support, there's probably other jobs for you. So, I mean, it's just kind of interesting to see what might happen. It's just really fascinating. Yeah.
It really is.
Not every employer, one of my sisters I was communicating with this morning said, I haven't mandated that my employees get vaccinated yet, you know, at a small practice. And so there are other employment opportunities. But, you know, they made this announcement as the Delta variant is kind of starting to burn its way through the U.S. And I saw this past week, we had two cases for a long time of the Delta variant here. Now we've got six, mm-hmm, and that's a small increase, but like last time I looked, it was two new ones, one in Ada, one in Twin Falls. I think No Canyon in Twin Falls County. So it's here.
And I think we would know that those numbers are low. I mean, you know,
oh, yeah, sequencing absolutely. Yeah, that's only the ones that they've been able to sequence. So yeah, it's what we don't want, again, as always, is to see our healthcare systems become overwhelmed because they have employees out sick, whether those are people who work in supply chain, IT, you know, people who help keep sanitation going in the hospital, bedside providers. Well, that's what happened in the last really huge surge is all around the state, we saw healthcare workers getting taken out themselves by the virus or their family members getting sick and they had to stay home with them or quarantine. And that's a big reason that these healthcare employers are saying, you guys need to get vaccinated, because if we end up getting a big wave, because we have so many people unvaccinated in the state, if we get a big wave again, I can't have you being out of work. We need to be able to help these people. So that is the driving reason for this.
Well, and then when you think about, you know, these unvaccinated individuals, and then we go into the winter months where, you know, people aren't masking anymore, right? I mean, whether you're vaccinated or not vaccinated, at least in Idaho. And then the flu season comes around, and we that could also complicate matters, don't you think, Audrey, when it comes to overwhelming our healthcare system in the winter?
Yeah, we'll see. We didn't see that last year, which was good. I hope that we had a lot more people get flu shots last year, I think, than usual.
I think so too.
And, you know, mm-hmm, let's hope that continues again this flu season, because it clearly helped. And a lot of the kind of respiratory illness, transmissible kind of efforts that we were making to keep that from happening, to have a twindemic, so to speak. You know, I don't know how many of those are going to carry on, but yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
It's a matter of time. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. Continuing our reporter roundtable, our guest today, Dawn Day with BoiseDev.com, Audrey Dutton with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News. And I should note that Joey is here with me and keeps asking questions. So never know. Yes, he is on his iPad.
That's a relief.
Jojo, Joey, let mommy do the show. Okay, thank you. All right. Audrey, There are multiple complaints against the Idaho Freedom Foundation, saying that they broke nonprofit rules. So can you start first for folks who may not be familiar with IFF, what it is, and then these complaints? It's fairly complicated.
Yeah, it is. So Idaho Freedom Foundation has been around for, what, a decade and a half at this point?
I think so.
A long time. And they advocate for conservative ideas, limited government, free market. And they have employees who have testified before the legislature. They have one of their folks is on the education task force, Janice McGann's education task force. And they're very, very heavily involved in politics. Mm-hmm. So how involved in politics can they be is the question.
The question of the day.
And right. So they also have kind of an attached group that I'll get into later, explaining what that is, but they put out a freedom index and they score bills, and then they score based on how they align with 12 values of freedom. And they kind of use that scoring system to grade lawmakers. I think someone was F minus at one point. So what's kind of new is that we talked with three folks who filed complaints in recent years with the IRS, alleging basically that the Idaho Freedom Foundation was violating laws for its nonprofit status, which allows it to collect tax deductible donations. It's tax exempt. It's a charitable nonprofit. And so one of the complaints was from a Democratic legislative candidate from Shelley, and he created his own nonprofit earlier this year. In the process of creating it, he became confused by how the IFF could be a tax-exempt 501c3. So he ended up filing a complaint to the IRS saying they're engaged in excessive lobbying. And then there was another complaint filed last year by Carrie Getty-Scheid, who served in nonprofits for many, many years in Idaho, including as board chair of the Idaho Nonprofit Center. And she filed a complaint with the IRS in April 2020 over their Disobey Idaho campaign and rally that encouraged people to violate the mask mandate, the Boise mask mandate, Governor Little's stay-home orders, et cetera. And then a former state senator, Sean Keogh, the longest serving woman in the Idaho legislature, she said she also filed a complaint with the IRS at some point in recent years. And she believes that they basically overstepped their limits by targeting her with the Freedom Index. So the question is, are they allowed to do this?
Right.
So I talked with Marcus Owens, who's the former chief regulator for nonprofits at the IRS, basically the guy who decides this stuff or used to decide this stuff. He's now in private practice. And he said these are complicated issues. So 501c3 is the charitable nonprofit Idaho Freedom Foundation can lobby, but they can't lobby more than an insignificant amount of their work. So
what does basically that mean?
Yeah, right. So there are two different standards, and the nonprofit can choose which standard it wants to be judged on. It can either be 20% of their spending or the quote more than an insignificant amount, which is somewhat subjective, but he said it's generally thought to be between 5% to 15%, somewhere in between. And that's their limit. But the IFF formed Idaho Freedom Action, a 501c4, mm-hmm. with the same staff in the same offices, and they can engage in lobbying and limited campaign activities. 501c4s can. And we've seen this with the ACLU, Sierra Club, the NRA. They all have both 501c3 and 501c4 groups. So end, but they can't bleed over into each other, into each other's work and budgets and things like that beyond what's allowed in the law. So what's allowed in the law? Well, the IRS would look at that and decide whether they're falling in line with the law or not. However, the IRS has been deeply underfunded in recent years and is currently behind on simply processing nonprofits' tax returns. Like what I've heard is a year behind. So much less investigating complaints against a nonprofit. And remains to be seen whether the requests for more budget from President Biden would go toward, you know, that enforcement activity, or if mm-hmm. it would go toward processing the tax returns, which generates revenue. And if your job is to keep a federal agency funded, where are you going to put your money? So these complaints could end up sitting there for a while, or they could maybe be picked up. Who knows?
Right. So once again, just having to wait and see. I appreciate though the breakdown of that, Audrey, because it is difficult to understand, I think, for, you know, someone who isn't like a tax attorney. Kevin, there are some possible big changes coming to the State Board of Ed. I mean, Governor Little recently appointed someone, but could be really potentially having the ability to change the dynamic of the board.
Yeah, so right in the middle of this election season, right in the middle of this firestorm over education policy in the state, Governor Little went to a pretty trusted ally this week and filling a vacancy on the State Board of Education. He went with Bill Gilbert, and that name is probably not a household name to many listeners, but he's reasonably well known in education circles. Gilbert co-chaired Governor Little's Education Task Force back in 2019. He'll take a seat on the state board subject to Senate confirmation next winter. The state board is a hugely important body. We're one of the few states in the nation that has a governing board that sets education policy for K-12 and higher education. So this board has a wide swath of powers and policy making influence. And Governor Little will get to pick two more members of the state board because Debbie Critchfield, who's now running for state superintendent, she is stepping down at some point. When a successor is named, she will step down. Emma mm-hmm. Atchley, who's been a longtime state board member from Eastern Idaho, from Ashton, she has stepped down. So there's actually a vacant seat on the board. So that's three state board members that the governor is going to get to name within a pretty short amount of time. And what it also means is that by the end of it, five of the seven appointed members of the state board will be appointees of Governor Brad Little. Kurt Liebig, who is now president of the state board, is a Little appointee. Sean Keough, who Audrey just mentioned before, mm-hmm. is on the state board now, and she is a Little appointee. So this is really going to become Brad Little's State Board of Education, right in the middle of this debate over indoctrination in schools and critical race theory and all of these mm-hmm. Issues that the Idaho Freedom Foundation has been leading the charge on. And right in the middle of this post-pandemic, well, we hope post-pandemic, time when education is looking at, when educators are looking at kind of bridging the learning gaps that we know took place as kids were forced to study at home. So it's a big time for the State Board of Education, and it's an election season. So these are going to be some very interesting appointments to watch for.
And I think, you know, yeah, as you said, Kevin, because there's so much going on, right? To just be aware of who he may appoint and how that may impact everything that you just mentioned.
Right. And, you know, I think the governor's, you know, motive, MO on these appointments has been pretty clear, because not just with Gilbert, but with Liebig and Keough before, he went to folks who served on his education task force from 2019. Right. He went with people he knows who have some business background generally. That's what he's been looking for. And I'll be really curious to see how he winds up approaching the other two appointments. And I asked his education advisor, Greg Wilson, directly, are you looking for diversity on the school board and the state board? Because there are no representatives of color on,
right,
on the state board. And when you think about it, Latino students make up about 1/6 of Idaho's K-12 students. I mean, it's a large constituency that right now there is nobody on the state board from that community. Wilson was fairly noncommittal. He said, we've looked at some candidates, but he didn't say, yes, this is a priority of the governor's. Yes, this is something that he wants to do. This is something he is committing to try to do. So we'll see what these other two appointments turn out to be where he goes to find new board members.
Mm-hmm. So Don, if you happen to be in Sun Valley this week, you might run into some billionaires because it's basically summer camp for billionaires is back.
Yeah, I was actually going to go up on Wednesday, but not because I'm a billionaire. I should be very clear. Not that anybody would have presupposed that. But
how well is Boise State doing over there? Wow.
I was like, man, did I exactly an implication out there? I mean, it's going great, but not billionaire great.
Man.
So, Joey, get your iPad. We we have gone up and covered it in the past, and it's pretty interesting. NPR News reported that the net worth of the attendees will cross $1 trillion. This is the annual Allen & Company conference that's held each year, except for, of course, last year at the Sun Valley Resort. And we put out a news story today that kind of wrapped up some of the things that happened this week. And I took that NPR report of $1 trillion in net worth, and I was like, well, let's see. Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates were there. And so that's already a third of $1 trillion, and that's just two people. But right. It's been interesting, and it's always interesting. This becomes the sort of spotlight of this nexus of media, tech, and even the political establishment that gather every year behind closed hedges, for lack of a better term, to hear talks. Variety reported that there was a session on e-commerce. There were sessions on the economic climate, criminal justice reform, creativity, immigration reform, all sorts of things that they're talking about. You have former Secretary of State, Republican James Baker, interviewing Warren Buffett. But then there's the deal-making aspect. So you get all these people together, exactly, that are titans of industry, and some really interesting deals have come out of this. The deal for Jeff Bezos to purchase the Washington Post was hatched at Sun Valley. Comcast purchase of NBC Universal was hatched there. Way back in the day, Disney agreed to purchase the ABC company, or didn't agree, but they started to talk about it there. And so you always wonder, like, well, what's going to happen? The New York Post, which is, kind of a tabloid, but they often have interesting mm-hmm. things, said that Sherry Redstone, who heads Viacom CBS, and Brian Roberts, who heads Comcast, which owns NBC Universal, met up. So you've got the heads of CBS and NBC meeting up, which is sort of fascinating in this era of media consolidation. And top folks at Disney and Netflix had conversations. So are we going to see those deals? Probably not, but you never know. And the other thing that I thought was interesting out of this week is the Wall Street Journal ran a fairly long, really detailed story on the economic struggles that Ketchum is having. And, I don't know that they would have done this otherwise, but it added some texture to this. You're seeing some protests in Ketchum this week, from what I understand, of people concerned about climate change, trying to get the billionaires' attention. So just a fascinating thing. It happens every year. I think our society and climate has changed. And once upon a time, you might have been like, oh, that's so cool. Look what's happening in Sun Valley. Now I think we all look at it and there's more questions to be asked. But it really is quite fascinating for those of us who, I think a lot of regular Idahoans have at least taken a stroll through the Sun Valley Village, and to think like, oh, hey, Mark mm-hmm. Zuckerberg was here a couple weeks ago. Always kind of interesting.
Well, and I think, though, Don, that nuance, as you mentioned, even with the protests and all of that, I mean, that's not happened before. And when you then see how these billionaires, dress down for this event, right, to kind of seem more like locals, like, they're wearing their Columbia gear and all of that.
They're all given windbreakers, in fact. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it feels in some ways in the climate that we live in right now, a little tone deaf, frankly.
Yeah, it, you know, it is interesting. And 2019, I talked to some of the economic development officials in Sun Valley and at the state of Idaho. And Harry Griffith, who heads up Sun Valley Economic Development, was like, this is an anchor for the summer season up there. Without Allen & Company, a retail shop might have one less employee. They know they can rely on being full during the week with the participants, security details, and setup teams. So it's a big piece of that economic puzzle up there, and they didn't have it last year.
Right.
So it's back. And one other note I'm going to put in here that I thought was really funny. The HBO series Succession, which is kind of a send up of the Murdoch family and some others. It's about corporate intrigue at a big media company. They picked the first day of the Sun Valley Conference to drop the new trailer for their upcoming season, which I am certain was not an accident.
I have a feeling you're right about that. Kevin, we briefly mentioned this a little bit earlier in regards to the real culture wars going on around education here in Idaho during this last legislative session. So where are we in regards to critical race theory? I mean, frankly, there were folks, including educators, teachers, who were Googling what critical race theory even is.
Right. And I tried to do a piece that tried to step back and look at what are we talking about when we really are talking about critical race theory. And the term has become sort of a catch-all for just about anything that people are concerned about with education and diversity and inclusion, you know. And we saw a case in point of that just about a week ago. The state board gave its initial first reading on a policy that deals with diversity and inclusion on the college campuses. And it's basically a policy that would say that the four-year schools are, you know, encouraged to create an environment that has room for, you know, a diverse student body. I mean, and it quickly became caught up in another round of the backlash about critical race theory when the policy really does not mention critical race theory, and diversity and inclusion programs aren't critical race theory. What critical race theory really is an academic study, a fairly arcane academic study of how racism is incorporated and maybe built into our legal systems, our institutional systems, whether you're talking about you know, housing policy or healthcare policy or the law itself. What critical race theory is designed to do is to look at whether whether and to what extent racism is baked into these institutions of government and public life. It doesn't really have as much to do with diversity and inclusion, but this policy, the state board policy, which will come back in August for a final reading and for final approval, this policy got, you know, kind of mixed into that whole debate over critical race theory. So looking down the road, end of August, state board is going to take up this diversity policy at the same time, during the same week, that Janice McGeehan's school indoctrination task force holds its expected to be its final meeting and the meeting where it makes recommendations in terms of policy. So if you haven't heard enough about critical race theory yet, just come back the last week of August. Wait. You'll hear plenty more about it.
Oh, I'm sure we will. You know, Don, we know that housing is so tight in many parts of Idaho, including the Treasure Valley. So there's an office building in Boise you recently reported on, and it could be torn down but replaced with housing.
Yeah, so I think we're going to talk about that more on Monday in Idaho Matters,
right?
The housing situation. But a couple of things that were interesting that surprised me this week, and one is a developer has applied with the city of Boise. I should be more specific. They have had a pre-application meeting with the city of Boise, so the formal application hasn't happened yet. Sorry, this is me just being very careful. but they have indicated that they are going to build a new 5-story apartment building along the Boise Greenbelt in the Lusk neighborhood. This is an area where we've seen a proliferation of apartment complexes in the last few years, primarily aimed at students. And there's like 1,000+ units back there. So the application this week was to take an old, not an old building, a building built in 2005.
Not really old though.
Yeah, no, I actually went and got a picture of it specifically to help illustrate how new this building is. It's a very nice looking office building along the Greenbelt. They want to tear it down and replace it with this apartment building. It's a little hard to describe where this is. It's on Lusk Street. It used to be home to Count. You know, it's got some tenants in it now. And what it, I think, shows is that the market is saying we need so many housing units right now that you have people who are looking at things that they may not have a few years ago. And they are saying, okay, you know what, we can take this building that's an asset that we could lease and put office tenants in and tear it down, get rid of that asset and build an apartment building. So it's like if you own a house, right, you're probably, if you want to make upgrades, you're probably not going to tear it down and build a new one because you
right,
blow up the value of the house. Well, same thing happens here, but now the market is saying, yes, we need so many housing units that it's going to make sense financially to put an apartment building in its place. So it's really interesting. I imagine we'll see a formal application here in the next few weeks. The apartment building itself, I wouldn't say is that interesting. In fact, there's a rendering, and in the rendering, you see like 4 other apartment buildings that look just like it. But it's the fact that we're now at this place where we're starting to see things replaced. And it's interesting. I've been seeing a bunch of little applications. We haven't done a story on this yet, but there are all sorts of older homes around town that were turned into offices, some near St. Luke's and some in the North End as it kind of abuts downtown. And I've been seeing all these applications to go the other direction, to take these homes that have been turned into offices and turn them back into houses. And those are just indications of how hot this housing market is right now. Yeah. People are looking at every option they can to have more units.
And you are going to be, as you mentioned, you are going to be back on the program on Monday to really dive into the housing market, because we also keep getting national attention. So we'll talk about how that plays into it as well. So Audrey, Central District Health is looking for a new board member. Dr. Ted Epperle, his position was not renewed. Now, am I correct in saying, is it state law that mandates that one position on the health district must be like a board certified physician?
As long as, or if there is a physician who's licensed by the Idaho Board of Medicine, who's able and willing to serve, that one of the seats on each public MD or
so
DO.
Audrey, you're cutting out. So can you say that again? Sorry, we heard the part about so you do have to be a board certified physician, correct?
As they can find someone who is willing and able to serve, who is licensed by the Idaho Board of Medicine, then one of the seats on each public health district board needs to be a physician.
And so they've got some applications in, one being Dr. Sky Blue, who applied for a vacant position a few months back, correct?
Right. He applied when the Ada County Commissioners instead selected former Congressman Raul Labrador. And they mentioned a few times during his interview, you know, you might want to apply for another seat that might come open. So he applied, and then there were a few other applicants, 2 other medical doctors, a chiropractor and a family nurse practitioner. The 2 other medical doctors were Dr. Ryan Cole and Dr. Travis Kemp. Cole is a pathologist who runs Cole Diagnostics, a laboratory, and Kemp is an orthopedic surgeon.
And then so at this point, what happens? How does a person become officially appointed then to the board? Because this isn't just Ada County. I mean, it's the entire central district.
Right. So the board is made up of, the public health board is made up of commissioners from each of the counties. And we're Ada, Boise, Elmore and Valley County are Central District Health. Obviously, Ada County is the biggest in those. But
right.
So Ada County commissioners choose who they want to nominate. So they nominate that person up to CDH. And then all of the counties that are part of Central District Health, their commissioners also need to vote, and that's how that person gets approved. So it's not like the Ada County commissioners make the final decision. However, it's mm-hmm. pretty likely that I think that whoever they choose would be in, would be accepted. So I did do a little bit of kind of backgrounding of these folks. I looked at their applications. I looked at their websites, social media posts, interviews. And then I also have talked with Dr. Blue before, interviewed him. I've talked with him several times. I've talked with numerous times during the pandemic because he was doing some of the testing. And then again, I talked with him kind of in depth because he's kind of become a public figure in the COVID truther movement, questioning whether the vaccines are safe, whether they're genuine vaccines or experimental treatments, and whether, you know, certain treatments that are not recommended by virtually every public health body are worth being given. Ivermectin is one of them. That's an anti-parasite drug. And he said he's been prescribing it to people. So the story goes kind of into detail about what he's said, and then a bit of fact checking on that. Some of what he says is accurate and backed up, and then other things, the studies that have been done contradict it. So
we will have to, so folks can read all of that at the Idaho Capital Sun. We have about 2 minutes left. And so, Don, I want to quickly talk to you about a proposed building that would become the third tallest building in Idaho, but it's not in downtown Boise.
Yeah. And so since I ran that story, I'm actually told it might be the fourth tallest. So I'll do this all in 2 minutes.
Oh, okay.
A developer. A developer who is building a project called the Boardwalk in Garden City at the Boise River and Veterans Memorial Parkway had previously announced and has started work on two apartment buildings. A future phase was going to include a 9-story boutique style hotel. Boise Dev's Margaret Carmel this week found out that the developer has said, you know what, that doesn't make sense to build a hotel there, but it would make sense to build an 18-story condo building. And so they went into Garden City Design Review for a preliminary hearing. What's interesting is Garden City does not have a height restriction in that zone. So they can build, I mean, as tall as they want, frankly. Yeah. And so that would be pretty interesting. It would add condo units, not apartments. So these are places that people would purchase with views of the foothills and the river. And it would be interesting because I think the tallest building in Garden City is like 4 stories tall. It's not very tall.
Yeah.
So this would be a pretty significant thing. The thing I found out is that there's actually a condo project that is in progress in Coeur d'Alene that would clip this by a little bit. So that's interesting.
We also have a
19-story apartment building that's in the works in downtown Boise. It would oddly enough be shorter than the condo building for reasons that we don't need to get into here. But lots going on right now on the housing front.
No kidding. And we'll talk more about that with you on Monday, Don. Thanks to our reporter roundtable, Kevin Richard, Audrey Dutton, and Don Day. And I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters on this Friday as well. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. Our executive producers, Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, as I mentioned. Stay cool, stay safe. If you can, and we'll see you back here on Monday.